Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Guess what, folks? Jeff's back.
What?
Yep, he's back.
You sure?
Yeah. You could, if you were a boy band, you could sing a song about it. Even if you'd never been in the place before, if you sang a song about being back, it just implies that you were once great, and then that'll be your first hit. Be great.
Oh. Well, I'm not going to sing a song about it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Well, actually,
you should join a boy band and sing a song about coming back.
Oh, okay. First, I have to find a boy band.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that is a problem.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach needs to do some disclaiming and disclosing and such as that. The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of the show, radio program, but it's also the name of a SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does business all over the country and is a fiduciary manager of investment portfolios and a RIN person and gives advice and things like that.
Wait a minute. Did you say and a RIN press and gives advice? And what is a RIN press?
You've never heard of a RIN person?
I haven't. Is it like a Renaissance festival and a prissy person at the same time?
You got
it's a
it.
RIN person.
I think that's probably it, you know, right there.
We're making up new words. You can write them down. Call Webster's. We will. It's. I like that word, actually, RIN person.
Well, that's figure out what
advice
it means,
given
but we
to
still,
RIN press.
Yeah, we give RIN press. But what we present on this radio program is not investment advice. It is educational because investment advice is only given to people based on their individual circumstances, and we don't know your individual circumstances. Well, some of you we do, but
I'm
not going to say them on the air because it would be a violation of the Graham-Leach-Bliley
Privacy Protection Act.
Protection
yeah.
Act. So, let's see, what else we got to say? The information we do present has been obtained from sources that we believe to be reliable and accurate. But we don't make any warranties or guarantees as to the completeness or accuracy of the information.
Yeah, and we guarantee that we don't warranty or guarantee any of the information.
I got to think about that for a little bit. We guarantee that we don't guarantee, but we don't issue guarantees.
That's the only guarantee that we're going to give is that we're not giving any guarantee. Wait a minute! We're stuck in a catch-22.
But, you know, a lot of people don't know what a catch-22 is.
That's sign of the times.
I also need to tell you that we don't get paid to do this show, and we don't pay to do this show.
But we do advertise.
We do advertise for the show on the radio station.
Yes.
Which, if you can figure out why we have to disclose that, you're welcome to let us know.
Well, I think it's a good disclosure. We're required to do it, but it really shows our intent here. We're not doing this as an advertisement. We're doing this as education. And that is as clear as we can say it.
I guess that's right.
And a lot of people pay for their time. So if we're required to disclose that we're not paying for our time, then I'm happy with that.
We're disclosing that we don't pay for this show.
But we don't get paid either, which I might be happier if they did pay us for it. But
I don't know. That would make us employees.
Yeah, we'd have to answer to the man.
The man?
Yeah. The man is either really, really a good person or a really, really bad person, depending on your tone.
Mm.
So if you say, you're the man, that's a compliment.
Well,
but you can say, don't be the man.
Another announcement is that the telephone number in here, if you want to join with us today, presuming that today is the 21st of September 2019, you can give us a call at 254-773-1400, and somebody already has.
Yes.
So the somebody who already has, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jeff, welcome back. Question, you mentioned it in the newsletter, and it's been in the Wall Street Journal, the interbank loan rate, I guess went up to 10%. It says it was a shortage of money. I've been trying to figure out why. Can you explain it to
yes. Yes, we can.
No. I don't know if we can actually
I think
explain.
I think we can do it. I've been thinking about this.
Thank you.
Okay.
Because it is complicated. It is so amazingly complicated.
Yeah. So,
I'm not sure anybody completely understands it.
This is the repo world. And if you were listening to this program about 4 weeks ago now, maybe 5 weeks ago, we spent some time talking about some of the problems occurring in the repo market. Repo is not your uncle that doesn't like to pay his bills having a car taken back by the bank. That's one form of repo, but it is there's not a market for the repo market out there. It's a fascinating legal area. It's one of the only places where it's still legal to have a gunfight in that repo market because you're in Texas allowed to protect your property. And the determination of whose property it is at stake. That's the whole question. So if you're defending it and you possess it, you're allowed to defend it. And as far as I understand, I'm not an attorney. This is what it was explained to me by a tow truck driver that also does repos, who's been shot 3 times. And the people that shot him, 3 different people, are not in prison because it was totally legal to shoot the repo guy. And it was totally legal for him to shoot back. But that's a crazy, crazy world, but it's a different repo market. The repo market that we're talking about, I've got to lay out some foundation here. The Federal Reserve.
Da-da-da-da.
What is it? Well, it is a regulatory authority and a group of banks.
It's also a big bank in and of itself.
Yeah, it's a big bank of itself. In the fact that it is and it has branches, the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and Manhattan and San Francisco and in Dallas, and this is all part of a bank, but it's also a system. So it's really hard at that level. You just have to say, all right, this bank is also a system for regulating other banks.
It's the banker's bank.
Yes, it's the banker's bank. It's the bank that the bankers go to when they need a loan.
There, that's good.
In the Federal Reserve Act, it's called the Lender of Last Resort, which is, I think, a very...
This is a place in the mountains in Colorado.
Yes, this is the last resort. Please stop here. No gas for the next 27 miles.
Right.
Okay, so the Lender of Last Resort. It means when a bank doesn't have enough assets on hand, they don't have enough cash on hand, and you want your deposits back. Where do they go to get the money? And wait, why didn't they have the money to begin with? So the reason this is the foundational stuff. So we'll talk about this and kind of build it up. Banks make money by loaning out money. Where do they get the money? From you. You deposit it with them. Who do they make the loans to? You. You being the general broad sense. People make deposits at the bank, and the old school way of doing banking is it was just a vault. You would show up with your assets, and they would lock the door on that stuff, and they wouldn't touch it, and you wouldn't touch it. But you had to pay them a lot of money to keep it, because otherwise they would just be holding your stuff for no profit if they're not allowed to touch it. Over time, they said, hey, instead of you paying us, we'll pay you a little bit if you let us loan out this money. So when you look at your bank account application, you'll see it on there. Your assets can be loaned out. That's how banks are now making money, though they're not making a huge amount of money doing it. So the Federal Reserve as a system has been charged by Congress to go out and make sure that the banks don't loan out too much money. So they have a reserve requirement. This is part of the reason why they're called the Federal Reserve. You are required as a bank to have a certain percentage of your assets physically present and a certain percentage of your assets electronically present and not loaned out.
And in a case of bank, we talk about assets in this case. A loan is considered an asset, but we're talking about cash here.
Right.
A certain amount of cash on hand.
Yeah. And when we say assets, this is the next part. To the bank, your assets are a liability. They're a loan. You have loaned them money that they owe to you when you show up. So you have to hold that as it's kind of reverse thinking. You think of your money at the bank as your money at the bank. It is. But it's a loan to the bank, and they owe you that money.
And in fact, most of it isn't there.
Right. And that's the way the banking system has worked for about 100 years.
And if you really want to understand it, watch It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, with Jimmy Stewart.
The
old savings and loan when he's in there saying, the money's not here. It's in Jim's house. It's in Susan's house. It's literally true. The runs on the bank that took place right before the Great Depression. So this is not the Great Recession, and those of you that are millennials, the Great Depression took place in the late 1920s and early 1930s, all the way through near the end of the 1930s. It was a very long, very nasty situation
economically.
Truly
Great Depression.
It was the greatest one I've seen, or I haven't seen it. So it wasn't great in the sense that we liked it. It's great in that it was really big. Okay, so banks failed because they weren't required to have assets on hand, to have reserves on hand to meet the demands. They also failed because the FDIC didn't exist. There's a whole series of things that didn't exist that were created afterwards to say, let's try to prevent all this from happening again. We're going to prevent a customer panic. And they built that up. And then in 2009, we had another version of a banking disaster. We had one in the 90s too, the savings and loan catastrophe. The Resolution Trust Corporation came in and bought them out. Then we had the Great Recession. These are big financial institutional collapses.
Minor correction. The Federal Reserve did exist in the 1920s and 30s.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. The Federal Reserve did. The FDIC did not. Federal Reserve came in 1908 after the collapse of 1907. So the Federal Reserve, the Congress said, well, right, we need somebody to be the last person that will always be there to lend to the banks so that the whole system doesn't fall down.
And of course, another interesting point here, if I could interject one.
Please do.
Most banks in the 1930s, prior to the banking holiday were in 1934, were not members of the Federal Reserve.
Correct.
Only the major banks are members of the Federal Reserve. The ones that were members of the Federal Reserve, the big city banks, didn't collapse. Because they could turn to the Federal Reserve
Correct.
And borrow money. But the little banks in the little towns all over the United States, the ones you see collapsing in the movies.
Jimmy Stewart standing there. This is not somebody in a big network of banks. This is it. This is the small town savings and loan.
They were insured by what's called a state guarantee fund.
And,
in which they would all pitch in if one bank went bad. And the problem is if they all go bad, there was not enough to pitch in. Which, by the way, is the way insurance companies are insured today.
And the thing with banks is if they're run well and they're following the rules, there's no real danger that the bank is in the middle of collapsing.
Mm.
Except that if the rumor goes out that the bank is in danger of collapsing, which causes people to remove their deposits and place them somewhere else, it can cause the bank to collapse. So it's very much like the stock market. If there's a rumor that there's something wrong with the company, that may be the thing that's wrong with the company, the rumor itself. So that's a concept that you just have to hold on to for a minute. So the Federal Reserve, since 2008, since 2009 and 10, Dodd-Frank came out, the Federal Reserve was given a lot more responsibility on how it regulated the banking world. Now they are mandating a higher percentage in reserves at the bank. At the same time that they're doing these stress tests, and there's and basically all of the banks that call themselves banks are some way related to the Federal Reserve now. They fall under the purview of the Federal Reserve. But here's where things get a little weird. The Federal Reserve is raising and lowering a short-term interest rate. That's what they talk about on the news all the time. When the Federal Reserve has raised or lowered or the Trump tweets about why haven't they? What they're doing is raising and lowering the rate at which they loan to these banks. So all these banks, if this is another little piece of history that's held over, when people complain about bankers' hours, you know, the bank closes the door at 3 o'clock. What in the world? Don't they work for a living? They're just fat cats. No, they're not. Well, they might be. That's kind of an irrelevant thing. They might be fat cats, but they're still working in there. Because they got to figure out how many loans did they do today so that they know that they didn't go over the amount that would cut into their reserve requirement. If the Federal Reserve says you have to have a certain amount of deposits on hand and they loaned out too much, uh-oh. Well, why would they loan out too much? Because they have dozens of loan officers. And in the middle of a loan, they may not be talking to each other of the tallying up how many loans go out in a day. So they close the doors at 3 to do that bookkeeping to say how much money do they need to get in loans from either the Federal Reserve or from other banks. And the Federal Reserve has some limitations on how much money you can get from them at that interest rate. Otherwise, it would be the sole source of profit. People would be getting loans from the Federal Reserve and then just turning around and loaning them out at a higher rate. They want these reserves to be based on the amount of deposits you actually have. Hopefully, this isn't getting too complex. So the bank doesn't have enough money on hand. They go to the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve says, hey, you need too much money, they've got to turn to other banks, the other banks that are not the Federal Reserve Bank. This is the repo market. The repo market is what banks charge each other, not what the Federal Reserve charges a bank, but the what the banks are charging each other for the same kinds of loans to each other. Very short term, sometimes overnight loans, just to meet their requirements for one day until the payrolls hit on the 16th across their little area that the bank covers and the deposits come up, and so the reserves are on hand. So then they can turn around and pay that loan back. They're very, very low-risk loans usually, very, because they're all following the same rules. And the banking system right now, other than this shortness of cash, is in great shape. So what happened this week is normally that repo market, the interest rates are very close to the Federal Reserve's rates. Well, this week on Tuesday, it went from about 2.25%, a little bit more than 2.25%, so it was around 2.35 to 2.5 spread up and down. It moves around during the day to 10%. What happened? Why is it that suddenly the banks were charging each other 10%? And this is an even better one, because a lot of people have heard the term LIBOR. If you have
I think it's LIBOR,
that there's a lot of in London, I'm sure they say LIBOR. So I think the pronunciation is rough. It's the London Interbank Offer Rate, where they are. It's the same thing, only international banks are doing it with each other. So the repo market here has been proposed as the alternative to the LIBOR, because those of you that have followed this or have had loans linked to the LIBOR, over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been some big corruption issues where people were rigging the LIBOR. The big banks were cooperating without telling each other that they were cooperating to manipulate the rates. And so there's just a lot of egg on faces, and there was no muffin to go with the egg. So this is really bad in the banking world. So they've been changing the LIBOR to make it more safe, or to make it safer. And the United States says, why don't we just use the repo rate? It's a very stable thing. Well, Tuesday, it was not stable. If you had your loan linked in every month, there's a date in that month that says on this date, we're going to add 2 points to the LIBOR. So if the LIBOR is 2%, for that month, you'll have 4% on your loan. Well, if it had been linked to this LIBOR rate and it was 2 points on top of, you would have had a month of 12% interest being charged on your loan. That would not have felt good. I don't think anybody would have been happy about that, because these loans are supposed to be very low interest, very highly secure loans that should not have high interest charges. What caused it? And that's now we're finally getting to the question. First, we had to define what the market is we're talking about.
Well, let me interject one. Why it's called the repo? Did you? I may have missed that when you called.
I didn't explain.
It's called the repo market because the bank holds a lot of T-bills that are paying a little bit of interest.
Yeah.
Or treasury, short-term treasury securities.
Sometimes long-term as well.
But they hold these treasury securities, which pay them a little bit of interest, so that their reserves can actually earn a little bit of interest.
Right.
And they're considered the same as cash, except for the fact they're not cash. They can't very well. If you go in and say, I want $10,000 from my account, they can't give you 10 T-bills.
Right.
So,
well, it would be one T-bill, because 10,000 is what they're.
Right. They can't give you 10 bonds, though, for example.
Right.
So what they do.
It's really hard to spend those at the grocery store.
They have a certain amount of cash sitting there that's not earning them any interest at all. And what they do when they run short on cash is say, look, I've got this, I need a influx of cash just for one day here to cover these withdrawals.
It's fully collateralized. I've got this T-bill from the U.S. government.
And I'm going to give you a 90-day T-bill for $10,000. You'll give me $10,000 in cash, and tomorrow I'll buy back the T-bill for $10,002 or something.
We'll pay you a little bit for the process.
And that's why it's called a repo market, because they don't actually sell the T-bill. Because if they sold all those T-bills, that would affect the interest rate on the T-bills and
right.
it would drive the entire market crazy.
They're using it as collateral. They're collateralizing their debt. They're saying, I'm good for it. Look, it's right here. It's in this
And then
this
the next day
bond.
They promise to repossess it and
right.
pay you the money back so
there you
get your cash back. But if nobody has any cash, nobody has enough cash.
And a lot of them have lots and lots of treasury securities.
And why do they have a lot of treasury securities?
Because the government's borrowing a lot of money.
The government is borrowing phenomenal quantities of money right now, short term. And so the banks wind up with a lot of treasury securities, which, by the way, they're forced to buy.
Well, they're not forced to buy.
Well,
they voluntarily are forced to buy.
They're voluntarily forced to buy, yes.
Yeah, the major banks, the really big banks, have entered into an agreement with the government to be, and they make a massive profit on this. So let's not make it sound like it's a horrible thing. They go into the treasury auction and they are required to bid at the auction. They're not required to buy. If they're outbid, they don't have to buy it. But they're required to bid so that there's a market for U.S. treasuries. They then turn around on anything that they did buy and offer it to their clients, their customers, which is why the vast majority of people, when they buy a U.S. Treasury security of any kind, buy it from a bank, not at auction. So these banks, they're called the primary purchasers, just because the government wanted to be alliterative and start the words with P. Primary purchasing. They're out there. They had to bid.
And that soaks up a lot of their cash.
Right. So now they're required to have reserves on hand, but they also have to use the same reserves to buy whatever they actually wind up winning at auction. If they bid on it and there's not enough bidders to go around because there's lots of debt for sale, or there's enough bidders to go around but they wind up buying a bunch of bonds in the process, they've got to pay for it. Well, you can count that as part of their mandatory reserves, but it's not cash. It's not dollars. It's a bond. So they've got to go to the repo market. And at the same time, on Tuesday, a lot of corporations paid their tax bill. You think, well, of course they did. This should be a good thing. Except when the taxes get paid to the government, the money leaves the banking world. So those same big banks that they're the primary purchasers are the ones that most of these big corporations use. They pay their tax bill, and the taxes are lower than they used to be, but there's more bonds in the bank than there used to be. So the corporations pay their taxes. All this money leaves the big banks right at the same time that auctions are going on. So they're requiring to bid when they're not exactly sure if they have the required amount of reserves on hand, and maybe if they have enough cash reserves on hand. So they all hit the repo market at the same time to say, hey, I've got all these ultra safe bonds. I will lend them to you for a day and pay you for it in the process, or give it to you as collateral as you pay me for it for the day, and then I'll buy it back. Except they all did it at the same time. And all the banks in the system were a little short of cash, both because of that and another trend. So this is the last piece that I'm going to throw in the puzzle. There are more pieces. That's the private banking world. I think most of you have recognized that Apple and Samsung and Google are all doing things to try to pay through your phone. And they're not the only ones. Amazon's working on, they've got their credit cards. Usually they use a major bank credit card. Well, Apple and Samsung and Google and Microsoft and a lot of the others that are going into this direct pay business are forming what in essence is a private bank. It's not part of the Federal Reserve System. They don't make their money on loans. They make their money on currency transactions, on moving money from one place to another, on fees, which is the old way banks used to do it. So the private banks don't have the same kind of restrictions. And yet some of them can still get FDIC insurance. This is something very important. If you are using private banking, check to see if it's FDIC insured. Most PayPal is not, but they have some FDIC products. So be careful out there. The insurance level may not be the same in the bank, but they typically right now are offering a higher interest rate on short-term money. And a lot of money has been leaving the traditional banking system with their abysmally low interest rates and going into high-yield savings at Betterment or at PayPal or at Samsung or Apple or all of these new and very large institutions forming what in essence is a private bank. And Facebook, a couple of months ago, announced that they were going to do something similar to that, only on the international market. They called it a cryptocurrency, but it's in essence the same thing. They want to run a private international bank. Samsung and Google and Apple are much more concerned about running a private national bank in the United States. That sucked a lot of money out of the Federal Reserve System. So there's less cash on hand when reserves are rising and demands on those reserves are also rising. So they're being pinched in the middle, and it's caused all of this effort to save people from a customer-driven bank panic on Tuesday caused the bankers themselves to panic, and that's why we saw that 10% spike.
Let me throw something else in here. There was an article in the Financial Times concerning what happened on the 3 days ending Friday, and it may continue. The Federal Reserve has set up a system now, so instead of having emergency infusions of money, they now have a system where any bank that's a member of the Federal Reserve can trot up to can immediately get a short-term daily loan, which they couldn't before, and it took a special act by the Federal Reserve before, which they thought was going to happen for one day.
Yeah.
The 53 or 56 billion went in the first day, and then the second day they thought it'd be over with. Except they did about the same amount the next day, and then they did it on Friday, and they said, "Well, it's all over. It's a short-term blip, but we won't know until Monday."
Monday, we might have more of the same,
it might go away.
Piece of this is that with the end of quantitative easing, the Federal Reserve itself. Has been pulling money out of the system. It's been raising the rates up till now, and that sucks money out of the system. Now they've started lowering rates, but the trade war is sucking money out of the system at weird intervals. Big chunks of money flying out to go to another country to get shipments before tariffs hit. Money coming out of what would have been a normal profit going toward tariff payment that would have been on deposit instead goes to the government. So there's some pretty fundamental issues going on.
What I wanted to say is that we've been talking about the fact that we have an inverted yield curve.
Yeah,
and
this is all part of that.
There it is. There's an inverted yield curve. It's generally an indicator that historically it's always been an indicator that we have a recession within 12 to 18 months. And 18 months from when it inverted and stayed inverted is now about 12 months away. So it would be reasonable to think that sometime in 2020 we'll get a recession. But why? Well, the reason is banks take your deposits short term, generally speaking. Unless it's in a CD and it's locked in, they take short term deposits, your savings deposits, your overnight deposits. They take corporate deposits. They take a lot of money in short term, pay you very little or no interest rate on short term money. And then they loan it out for people to buy cars and bulldozers and things like that. And they loan it out anywhere from up to 5 years typically, because that's the typical loan period for a piece of equipment or a piece of computer or something.
It's considered the short-term durable loan.
So they're basically in the position where they say interest rates are higher at 5 years. Therefore, we'll make a profit because we're paying you interest based on very, very short-term rates. And we're loaning money based on five-year rates. Well, five-year rates are abysmally lower than short-term rates
So
every time that they try to make a loan, the bank, a standard loan in the economy, the bank winds up losing money, so it's not at all interested in making the loan.
So throw this piece in here. So how is it that last month automobile sales were up? And this is another piece of the private banking world. The dealerships have access to money from the corporations that are building the cars that are, in essence, private banks. They're actually making the loans. The same's true if you buy a house from one of the corporations, one of the big chain corporations like KB Homes. when you buy that house, they would like you to use their mortgage, and they can even sometimes, and you have to be careful about this, because sometimes they're a loss leader with their mortgages, and sometimes they're making a big profit. Most of the time, these big chains are using their mortgage operation as a loss leader. They make all their profit over on the home building and enough to pay for the debt on the mortgage.
And that works with cars, too.
And that's why the car sales work.
But this is the point. The banks are in a position where making standard traditional loans is not profitable.
So why should they make loans?
So instead of making loans, which they have a system for regulating and saying, here's how many loans we made, here's how much reserve we need to have, that all works very, very well. But when they stop making regular loans and have to start trading treasury securities in order to make money,
that's not good.
Then it shortens the time period they're doing this, and it makes it far more unpredictable. And you throw in, now I'm going to throw one more element in here. You throw in the fact that the loan demand driven by business is normally fairly predictable.
Yeah.
Because of the trade war,
it's not predictable anymore.
Businesses are suddenly not borrowing money and then suddenly needing to borrow a lot of money in a short period of time. It's become very, very unpredictable because every time the president tweets a new trade policy or moves the date of a tariff around or raises a tariff, it causes a ripple through the system that affects the banks and the amount of money they hold in reserve. And the banks are fighting to try to make a profit in an era when it is essentially not profitable to make loans.
Yeah.
And as a result, we have a very unpredictable short-term financial situation going on.
This is a generality to help kind of seal this all together. Currency, the word, comes from liquidity and flowing. A healthy economy, its currency flows around. It doesn't build up in big bank accounts and then not flow. It flows around, and that helps to build the momentum of the flow. That's the momentum of the economy. When it starts getting erratic in its flow, either by stopping completely, which is what happened in 2008 when we had a complete credit freeze. Credit freeze, even the word freeze, is we're talking about liquids. The money's flowing, the liquid form of it, the currency is going in its current, and then it stops because the banks aren't loaning money. Loans are still happening in our economy, but the primary on where the loans are coming is being redefined. That means that Congress needs to make some decisions right now on how to define a bank. Right now, a bank definition is anybody that calls themselves a bank. Well, PayPal's not calling themselves a bank. GM Finance is not calling itself a bank, but it's making loans and making profits from loans. So if we're going to regulate part of the loan making world, but not the other part, because that other part, who would put all their deposits at a place that wasn't even a bank, was the old question. Nobody would trust that.
Yeah, they would.
Except that now the banks are not very trusted because of the financial collapse in 2008. So Betterment and PayPal and Apple and you just go down the list. There are dozens of them out there, and the number of billions is now in the numbers of trillions at deposits at these private banking institutions. That pulls money out.
And speaking of pulling money out, we probably ought to pull some commercials out and do
that. Yeah, and I'm gonna plug a commercial even before we play commercials. Today in Salado, there is an amazing event taking place. It is the Culinary Arts Festival. They are going to have all kinds of goodies going on. And it's going on all weekend, but today has some of the best events. There is a fondant molding operation going on at a potter's shop where you're actually using fondant instead of pottery. Instead of throwing pottery, you're throwing fondant.
Which is like cheese.
I think it's either melted cheese or melted icing or melted chocolate. It sounds really cool. There are amazing restaurants.
There's a grape stomp.
That is the one I really want to plug because it is – the grape stomp is at the Salado Winery, and it is exactly what it sounds like.
A bunch of people getting into a barrel and stomping on grapes.
More than one barrel. So they're having competitions and stomping grapes. There's an I Love Lucy look-alike contest because I Love Lucy's one of their most famous episodes was Lucy stomping around in the grapes. So this is going to be a big thing. Who doesn't like to go
and watch Lucy stomp grapes?
Right, while drinking wine and possibly eating chocolate or some other wonderful
or pizza
food. Yeah, pizza, chocolate, barbecue. The choices are everything from fine dining all the way down to
crude dining,
which yes. Tends to be my preference.
Which like West Texas Intermediate crude.
Exactly. So we'll be playing some commercials now, but I do highly recommend if you've got some time. It's really hard to go wrong with the spousal unit. If the female of the spousal units is listening right now, your other spousal unit will have something they will enjoy in Salado. If the male spousal unit is listening now, the other spousal unit will have something they'll enjoy in Salado today. So I highly recommend it. And now we're going to play some commercials. If you'd like to call in and join the conversation, the phone numbers in here are 254, or phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back. Forecasting of the recession is one of the pieces that causes the recession to happen.
And it's the collective.
They're interlinked.
And it really boils down to the collective wisdom of a lot of people who are borrowing and loaning money. And
right.
When the collective wisdom says.
Or lack of wisdom.
A year from now, we're probably going to be in a recession. They have been amazingly accurate in doing that forecast. Now,
how is it that they come up? Because this is really a fun thing to apply a magnifying glass to. How is it that, you know, they say that they're not making the decision, we're going to be in a recession next year, so I'm going to put all my money in long term. What they're saying is, I'm afraid.
Right.
That's the sentiment.
They look at the big situation and they say, I can either invest this money. And when I say invested, in many cases, it's just like buy a new bulldozer or buy a new tractor or build a new building.
Or put up a plant for a manufacturing facility.
In which case, I think I'm going to make a profit because I look at the cash flows going in and out, which I'm not telling anybody about. I'm looking at the order flows. I'm looking at everything that's going on. And I'm thinking that over the next 10 years, I can make a good profit if I invest that money now in a business. Now, but on the other hand, if they say, things are really uncertain.
I'm not sure I could make a profit or not. I don't have the information available to make this decision.
I think I could lose that money very easily because I think we're pretty much overloaded and I don't see any way that we're going to continue to make the profit margins are going to continue to go up or anything is going to continue to go right, in which case you go buy a treasury.
Because it's
10-year treasury, because 10 years from now, they will definitely give you back the amount of money that you loaned the United States government, the dollars, and they will pay you interest along the way, in which case not much interest, about 1.7% a year, but 1.7% a year is about what inflation is running, so at least I won't lose any money.
So
when a lot of very wealthy people
are saying, I'm uncertain about being able to make a profit in the near future with this money. I'm going to put it someplace where it's ultra safe.
Then that collective wisdom of a lot of business owners and a lot of investors who have a lot of money generally tends, it's kind of like a crowdsource.
Right.
It's generally tends to be right historically. And we don't even think about it, it's just collectively. And of course, the fact that they're not investing the money, and we see things like the fact that business investment has been falling ever since the tariffs were put in.
And bank reserves have been falling over the last 2 years. So you put the two together, that money's leaving the banking system, money's not being reinvested, but we're at record profits or near record profits. I mean, we're right up close to the very top. It's a little bit receded from where it was, but if you look back at history, we're way above where we were. So where'd the extra money go? Well, we can see it. It's being sucked up by the bond market,
and
the long-term treasuries.
You throw in the fact that the United States government, which it doesn't normally do at the peak of an economic expansion, is borrowing record amounts of money. I mean, we have borrowed more money in a year than we're borrowing this year, but we've never borrowed this much money in the middle of an economic expansion. And when the United States government borrows a lot of money and it sucks money out of the system, that slows the economy down.
usually it spits that money right back into the system. So it can slow down the economy and then speed it back up. It doesn't speed it up sometimes as fast as it takes it out. Sometimes it's just as fast as it takes it out. Very rarely it speeds it up a little bit more. What's happening now is that there's a lot of confusion over how money's being spent at the governmental level. Money's being moved around from one program to another to pay for things in an emergency situation.
Like the emergency shuffling of money for the wall.
Right. So that money isn't being spent into the economy in the same places. It's being sucked up by smaller banks or by private banking rather than going – or credit unions, which a lot of very different credit unions. So it's not going to the primary purchasing banks that are buying the big loans. So they had to buy – and they're not having deposits come back into their banks from the government spending. That's part of the issue. Is that the money's coming out and the government very nearly shut down again.
But it's important to note here.
And it's coming up on another very near shutdown again in the very near future, as in 1 week from now.
And this is something we can talk about again, more of next week. At the same time as you've seen the stock market over the last 12 months, despite all the ups and downs.
Uh-huh. Flat.
Exactly. In essence, after we account for inflation, exactly where it was a year ago. It hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't gone up, hadn't gone down.
And but it's done a lot of both, but it has wound up being exactly where it was.
It's important to remember that the stock market is a forecaster. It forecasts future profits. And what it says is the forecast for future profits is zero.
We don't know is what it's saying.
And so that's an important thing to recognize. And then to get off the market just a second, the leading economic indicators from the Conference Board came out this week.
Right. And it says the same thing the market is. Not up, not down. It's the same thing the market is.
And it was zero 2 months ago, and it was up 0.4, and then it was back down to zero. In essence, when you look at the underlying factors in the leading economic indicators, about half of them are up, which is employment, consumer spending. Those are up, and they're generating the strength in the economy that keeps it from shrinking. But what's down?
Home purchases, housing starts on the single family homes.
And so what we're getting is this peculiar situation where we're teetering on the knife edge, and we have been ever since the tariff started. And this is something that I think is very important for our listeners to be aware of. If you're living off your portfolio, if you anticipate, you know, you basically have an investment portfolio, any shock could at any moment tip us into a recession. We don't have momentum on the upside. We are cruising along in what in 1929 would have been called a permanent plateau of
prosperity.
No. But it isn't permanent. It is a plateau, and we are not growing. We're growing. The economy is growing probably at about a 1.8% average annual rate. It was growing at 3.1 at the beginning of the year, and now it's down to about 1.8. In other words, our rate of growth is decelerating. Now, what does that mean to you? That means be aware. Don't get out of the market. Man, if you try to time the market, that's the one thing I can tell you that historically doesn't work. But be aware that you need to have your reserves and not assume that the stocks are going to take off suddenly and go up into the stratosphere. They might.
Right.
But if they do, that will be the death knell for this market.
The other side of this is that, and a death knell might be a little hyperbolic, a little over the top.
For the expansion, because I think it would indicate
it may stop the expansion.
That would kill the expansion.
The idea here that we're talking about is that recessions are normal. And just because we're having one doesn't mean this is a horrible, horrible thing. We need recessions in order to clean out the inefficient parts of our economy.
We're not having one. It's just because we're going to have one.
Right. We're going to have one. And unfortunately, people measure when people talk about a coming recession, particularly in a political season. It's either portrayed as a political, hey, this president's doing this bad thing, or portrayed as a, hey, we'll win if the president is in the middle of a recession. Take a step back. Recessions economically are absolutely vital for the health and welfare of our system. If you think of the 1970s, when we were at peak bloat for our economy. We had zero competition from the end of World War II all the way up to the late 70s. The unions were asking for lots of extra money, and they were getting it. The cost of everything was going up significantly because everybody had a job and everybody expected to have a pay raise. And we didn't have any competition, so we could charge as much as we wanted. In the 80s, at the beginning of the 80s, the Japanese came in and started giving us a serious run for our money. And we had a recession. And coming out of that recession, we were mean, lean, and it caused a boom that is still referenced back as the 80s and 90s boom, because we had a series of really good recessions to keep us lean and mean and focused on doing the things that we do the best that we do in the world. We're back in that place again. Prices are coming up. If we don't get a clean out, if people just get raises forever, if prices just keep going up forever, everybody has a job, so why is that a problem? We stagnate. Innovation stops. Innovation takes place in recessions. When people, very smart people, lose their jobs and they're sitting in their garage waiting for another job, and they say, remember that idea that I drew up 3 years ago? I'd really like to follow that up while I'm waiting for my job to come through. And then eventually they're hiring people because that idea is making money. And if you think back to when Apple launched the iPhone, you realize that that came right in the middle of the Great Recession. New ideas and innovation require hardship. Just ask any artist or musician. Without hardship, we're just fat, dumb, and happy. And not that I'm complaining about being fat, dumb, and happy, because I enjoy being fat, dumb, and happy. But if I don't get out and move around, my heart's going to stop. You can stretch that analogy as far as you want to and mix the metaphors in the process. So get a plumber for your heart. And what else should we mix together? Any other thoughts on this? We're about out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice customized to individuals at our office in Salado. The phone number locally for voicemail is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of this radio program going back lots of years. We've got newsletters and philosophy and links to educational material. You can also contact us directly through the website, through the contact form, or email us directly at jeff at tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com. You have about 10-second wrap-up, do you think?
Yeah, we got lots more to talk about next hour, and some major events that are still occurring in the economy that we haven't even discussed. So be sure and tune in an hour from now. This is the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure, and we look forward to talking to you again at the beginning of next hour.